This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn. I'm Chua and Tick. Last week, we celebrated the Teachers Among Us. May 16 was chosen as Teachers Day because it was on this date in 1956 that the Razak Report was formally endorsed by the Federal Legislative Assembly of Malaya. What did the report achieve and how much of it remains in our education system today? Here to tell us is Professor R. Santhiram, Dean of the School of Education, Languages and Communications at Wawasan Open University. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the invitation to come over.
So the report is named after the second Prime Minister, who was then the Minister of Education. Can we start by you maybe giving us the context of why the Razak report was needed at the time?
Basically, when you look at the Razak report and why it, at the time it came out, it was basically to devise an education policy for an impending independence. When we become an independent nation, we must have a proper education policy, and in preparation of that, because two or three attempts were done by the British, and you would notice that they were not successful. One was the Barnes report, the other was the Fenwu. But both these reports weren't planned for our new nation.
There are camps that are not happy with Barnes and not happy with the Fenwu. Yeah. Because I think I want to understand what were the compromises that were made.
Yes, because those were the two things. Those were the ones that the British, the colonial masters, introduced. They felt that there was something needed to improve the system of education for the Malays at that time. And Barnes was basically to review education for Malays.
Why was the education of the Malays at the time inadequate?
Because Malays only had primary terminal education. They had nothing beyond that. They had their primary education, and after that, they had to go, if they wanted to go to an English school, there was no avenues to go in, except for the rich and some of the members of the nobility, and some a selected few that went to English schools.
So it was a norm at the time to not go to secondary school because all the schools were English medium?
All the secondary schools and some Chinese schools, English and Chinese, not the Malays or the Tamil schools. They were basically primary. And when the Barnes came out, their remit was basically to review education for the Malays. But they went on further and prescribed a kind of education that was for the entire nation. They said, okay, we will have a bilingual education in Malay and English for the primary level, and only in the English medium in the secondary level, with Malay as a language. That was proposed, and they said, this is for the entire nation. Everyone else has got to fall in line with this. That is a kind of intent that Barnes had.
So what's wrong with that? Why? Who were opposed to that? Why is it not acceptable?
The Chinese had a proper system of education built on private enterprise. They had a very strong affinity towards education and believed that education would help move them up socially. So that, and that they were so attached to the Chinese culture and language, and they wanted a Chinese medium education. And there was already a Chinese medium education that took children right up to secondary level. And when they saw this, this would mean dismantling all that and just going in and doing the primary education in Malay or English. And secondary education will be basically in English, with Malay as a second language, without any provision for the learning of mother tongue at all. So they just couldn't take that. So that was a basic opposition that came on.
So this was rejected, and then the British commissioned another report called the Fenwu Report. And so what was the content of the Fenwu Report?
The Fenwu Report then, if you look at some studies that have done an analysis of Fenwu as well as Barnes, they begin to tell us that both these reports were not antagonistic to each other, but they were just different views, differing perspectives, different ethnic groups from a different vantage, at different vantage points. They look at education and say, this is what is suitable for a multicultural, multiracial nation. So that, and but so what Fenwu, the two chaps who sat and deliberated with the Committee on Chinese Education, They recommended that Chinese education be kept the way it was going and sought a multilingual and multicultural approach. It was more an integrationist approach they wanted. And they said that Chinese students would be able to be trilingual. You just let them learn Chinese, English, and Malay. And he said that would be what would provide the kind of things that the Chinese wanted.
So that sounds like a compromise. Why were the Malay nationalists then not happy with the Fernwu report?
The Malay nationalists, because for them, they would have preferred a secondary education in Malay. But Ban's report itself just said that secondary education is going to be English, in English, with Malay as a second language. That didn't satisfy the aspirations of the Malay nationalists. So they came up very hard. And so it looked like both these groups were not satisfied. And to the Indians, to a certain extent, to a lesser extent, the Indians came in and said, look, we also would not agree with the Ban's report because there was no provision made for mother tongue instruction at all. Though they went on to say that we would take a gradualist approach and slowly introduce Malay and English, and we are okay converting to an English medium later or to a Malay medium later, because the Tamil school system didn't have that Tamil secondary school system. So now you have three versions after these two reports. Everyone is arguing further from their own vantage points.
So Barnes is recommending a common language, right? And the Fernwu report is recommending a common curriculum with different languages.
The curriculum aspect has not been discussed as yet.
Right. So how does the result report come into play then? What were the middle ground?
Yeah. The middle ground was exactly what a Razak report, because we were working towards independence, self-rule and independence. And in order to gain the confidence of the colonial rulers to give independence to the nation, there must be a semblance of unity among the races. So when the Razak committee sat to discuss education, Razak's main concern was national unity and social cohesion and fostering national consciousness. So the people who crafted that report had to give in to some of the demands of the minority racial groups in the country. For instance, they gave in to the issue like multilingual primary school system. That means they wanted the Chinese, Tamil, and Malay medium and English medium schools to exist. But they were very firm on secondary education. They wanted an English medium education, and then it was to be converted to a Malay medium after a certain period of time. So that's the difference between these three reports, Barnes, Fernwu, and Razak.
If I understand it correctly, the Razak was giving in to the Chinese education movement as well as other ethnic minority primary school vernacular education.
They can
keep that to maintain the culture and languages. Mm-hmm. And they assuage the concerns of the nationalists by streamlining mainstream education in Malay language.
Yeah. So that's one thing. But you see, Razak report wasn't very clear on Chinese secondary education. The report didn't come up with a firm statement on it. In some parts of the report, it states that the report recommends the establishment of one type of national secondary school where all the pupils work towards a common final examination. So it clearly states that the intent is one national secondary school where the pupils work towards a final examination, one final examination. It didn't state whether it's Chinese, English, or Bahasa Malaysia. Mm. You see that?
And I am sure the Chinese educationists would have picked up on that.
In a sense, the report, initially Razak report, says some interesting things. It says this. It says, we see no objection to the learning of three languages in the secondary schools or the use of more than one language in the same school as a medium of instruction. You see, both these two statements taken together contradict each other. And I think the Chinese educationists were well aware of it. But MCA, as the political party representing Chinese interests, wasn't prepared to take up the battle for it. That was where the issue was. Because as far as we know, the Central Education Committee in MCA was strongly opposed to the result report. It was very strong. But MCA was not prepared to fight the battle out for them. Because you would understand that at that time, independence, gaining independence, was in the minds of all the political elites, whether it was Malay political elite or Chinese political elites or Indian. The alliance, the intention was, and they didn't want to, they wanted to put out a semblance of unity among themselves. So that is where you would find later, MCA went into a lot of political turmoil within itself because of some of these conditions later on when the things took place. Because you would notice, if you know the system, what took place after that. Immediately after the promulgation of Razak report in 1956, the Ministry of Education sent a circular to all secondary Chinese secondary schools saying that they have to send their students will have to sit for the LCE and MCE examinations in English. That was a shocker for them, because their system was in Chinese, the students were not well prepared, and in end of 1956 itself, this came about, the statement. But luckily, the Chinese schools stood firm. They refused to allow their children to sit, because it's educationally impossible for children to be prepared in the mother tongue all along and sit for an English examination. So you see, they were aware of it. Razak report was very ambivalent about the whole thing. And then they slipped in this at point when they said, Razak report is done. Let's get it implemented like this. That went on, the battles. That is why I think the Chinese education is always a bit suspicious of efforts. Anything that the government does, they take it with a pinch of salt and say, let's look at it first. We want to review it. We don't want to be caught in the wrong foot, like what happened in the Razak report stage.
I'm speaking today to Professor R. Santiram of Wawasan Open University. We'll talk more about the legacy of the Razak report after this short break. BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Intik. My guest today is Professor R. Santiram, Dean at the School of Education, Languages and Communications at Wawasan Open University. We're talking today about the Razak report. Professor, we have what researchers call the pluralist dilemma in Malaysia because of our multi-ethnic composition. Can you tell us what that is, this dilemma?
The pluralist dilemma. The term itself, pluralist dilemma, was propagated by Brian Balivan in his book, The Pluralist Dilemma in Education. He had an article or a book, and he did a piece of research on that, and we have borrowed that term, the pluralist dilemma, in our writings as well. You see, it's applicable in a multiracial society. In a multiracial society, you have majority interests, you have minority interests. You have these two things at different poles. They are all interested in getting the best for themselves. But you can't have everything. Because how do you accommodate the interest of minorities within the larger context of nation building? That's a difficult thing to do. You see, you'll have to balance the needs of these two groups. Someone has to sacrifice.
And do we know what the answer is? What does the research say on what works best in a multi-ethnic country where there is a majority language and there is a minority population who is required to be proficient in that majority language?
If I go back to the research to see what the research says is good for a multi-racial society or a multi-ethnic society, for education, majority of the reports say that it is best that the child's education be started off in the mother tongue. That is a given.
That's accepted wisdom.
That's a wisdom.
Why is that? Why is that so?
Because you're looking at a child, say, 5 or 6 years old. He knows only his mother tongue at that time. He knows the mother tongue. He has been initiated into the culture. Psychologically, that's what he knows. Socially also, he mixes with that kind of people. And suddenly you take him out and plant him in an alien environment to learn a different language. It's going to be traumatic for children. Most of the research, even as early as 1953, reports have said that there are a lot of advantages for the child to learn in the mother tongue. They cite advantages in like psychological, cognitive education, and social advantages of mother tongue education in the early years. I can quote you the authors who have already done this. They always say that if you give the child a good mother tongue instruction in the early years, if they get a strong foundation that will help him to acquire a second language better. It is known as the interdependence theory. And there are quite a lot of people who have written about these things, you know, how mother tongue. And the problem is, if you ask me what is the best, you'll start off with that and then slowly move into the mainstream system. You'll have to. That is how, but when you move into, it is decided by the context. Say Canada, for instance, we said the French Canadians start off in French first. Then at a certain point in their primary education, they switch over to English. The same thing happens in Finland and Sweden and all. Most of them have a lot of guest workers and migration, people coming into work and whatnot. They also do this. First, you start off with your mother tongue. Then you switch over. Even in the U.S., the southern parts, we talked about it, where they start off with, say, Spanish. Then they slowly move over to English. So it's different. There are various models existing about how you could move from, how you could transit. You start off with mother tongue and transit, and then follow the mainstream medium.
But mother tongue is something we have to define, right? Because in the Malaysian context, for example, it could be a Chinese family or an Indian family, but if the child grew up speaking English as the first language, then mother tongue becomes an entirely different thing altogether.
That's true. The child, even though he's born a Chinese or a Tamil or a Punjabi or whatever, they are cultured into speaking English. In that sense, that is why there is a battle going on in Malaysia, saying we can start our children in English and whatnot. It is amongst the elite and the upper middle class these things prevail, where they want their children to follow an English education. And they think the rest of the country is like that. The rest of the country isn't like that. The rest of the country, the children are rural children. Even among urban Chinese and Indians, they talk in the mother tongue. And you can't expect them to provide the same kind of interaction in English that children of the elite are exposed to. So it's kind of
a constant struggle between the needs of nation building versus economic necessity to speak in this language of commerce in the private sector, isn't it? I used to think that Malaysia was such a unique case until I read about the complexity of Eastern European countries and, you know, Canada is one that you cited, and as well as like Belgium or Switzerland, who they have Dutch, German, Italian, and on top of that, English.
Yeah. But if you talk about, say, the German context, you cannot say they have they have all these languages, because the country is divided into so many cantons, and whichever country it borders, that part is completely sometimes French-speaking. Everyone speaks because you're closer to France. This part will be closer to Italy, and they speak Italian. The other part is closer to Germany, and they speak German. So you find a mishmash of all these things. So it's kind of difficult to say, what would you learn? You would learn your mother tongue or the cantons, because in Switzerland, for instance, they're not education is not federally dictated. It's all decided by the cantons. So if the canton belongs to an area which in which the majority are French-speaking, then everything is in French. But they make provisions for them to learn another language or two.
So do we have to be... Can we be happy with that? Is that the direction, the future direction of how education model should be? Like, should we not be so hung up on having this one language that can be a uniting factor in, across the country?
I don't know. Different people see it differently. Yeah. You know, some of the much more older, mature democracies, they're quite open about it. But, and it also depends on the strength of the minorities. For instance, would the Chinese in Australia demand for Chinese education? Or in Canada or in United States or even in Britain? They cannot, because we are such a small minority, even the Indians there. So they make some kind of provision among themselves to give mother tongue instruction among communities, say, organize it in some areas, some temples somewhere, and give them that. And they follow the mainstream education. So there is a kind of unofficial mother tongue instruction, and learning goes on after school hours, for instance. Yeah. And then they go into the mainstream. So that is the way you compromise. You cannot say this is how we should go, because we are a new democracy. We're a new independent. We are hardly 60, 70 years old, and we are always very sensitive to these things. You look at the case of Indonesia, for instance, assimilationist. Some people want, used to tell us, so if you want to learn Chinese language has gone underground because they'll be persecuted. You cannot. So what happens? Chinese send their children over to Malaysia. They come to Penang, they come to, I don't know whether in KL, to learn Mandarin and be educated in Chinese medium schools. That's how it is. Singapore, for instance, is a very good example. Earlier, Singapore started like this from the early days, where we had Chinese, Tamil, Malay, and English and all that. After independence, Lee Kuan Yew said, everyone, do this. And slowly phased out the vernacular mediums.
So what was problematic about the way we have gone about implementing this system of ours? Because you call it in your book, Transitional Bilingual Education. The book, by the way, is Educational Issues in Multi-Ethnic Malaysia.
Yeah.
You call it Transitional Bilingual Education. Is there a better way we can do it?
I don't know whether there is a better way. We have read quite a bit, my co-author and myself, we have been in this area for quite a bit of time. But I don't think there is a better way.
Just to explain to the listener what the transitional bilingual education means, it's like 6 years of instruction in your mother tongue. Then a drastic transition into secondary education where it's in Malay.
Yeah. Yeah. You have the transition need not be as drastic as you say. The transition, they transit into a removed class where they have a 1 year removed class of national language immersion. And then they, having gained enough proficiency, they move on to the secondary level and go on in the Malay medium. That is what. But now it is becoming a bit blurred in Malaysia.
How so?
You would see that this has been the trend all along. There are a lot of international schools coming into Malaysia now. There are close to 170 international schools in Malaysia.
I think it's the most in Southeast Asia.
I don't know whether it's the most, but in Malaysia, 170 international schools. All of them have been given permission to run their schools in English medium. That is another stream.
Do you see that as a solution or another problem?
I don't see it as a problem. I see it as a response to globalization. Even right now, you would see multilingual medium of education in the primary system. In the middle, the secondary has become Malay and English and Chinese in the non-conforming schools. It's going on there. Those three things are going on, Malay, Chinese, and the international schools, about 170, and there are many more that will be coming up. And at the tertiary level, you see Malay medium, and there is a trend again to open up the country to a lot of private education. The private education system has got something like how many private schools, private institutions, 300 or over, or close to 400 over institutions, I think there are. Most of them are conducting their instruction in English. So you see how, even though the framework has been set, we have tweaked it here and there to suit the needs of the times. That's a way to go, I think. So that people are not so much hung up on, oh, you must go on to do this language through only this language and nothing more. So look, this is the needs of the system, and this is the trend. International trend is globalization. Let us follow that.
One argument that I got from your book was that the concern of conservatives who have about having the medium of instruction in English is that then they don't absorb the culture of their own heritage. They absorb the culture of the English language, which is Western and liberal in nature.
Yeah.
And so there is this element of cultural hegemony and linguistic imperialism.
Yeah.
Is that argument persuasive enough to not put English as the medium of instruction in Malaysia?
I don't know. You are looking at other issues that will come up because of use of English, loss of culture, loss of...
So I guess the question is, how do you reconcile the place of English, which is the forces of globalization is putting on us in our education system?
You can't halt it, right? If you don't do anything about it, you're going to lose out because other nations are paying much more attention to English. And even though they haven't, we don't know whether they've got English medium schools and universities, but definitely everyone's paying more attention to learning English. And that is the way to go. But we should not be overly worried about whether we are going to lose cultural identity. Cultural identity grows with the people. Japanese, in spite of being so modern, they're still attached to a lot of their own cultural values. You'll be surprised at how modern Japanese thought is, Japanese inventions are, Japanese industry has progressed so much. They are so attached to their Shintoism, the Japanese cultural practices. That goes on a different level. They see the importance of both.
Can you tell us about how our government has gone about trying to desegregate education in Malaysia?
They have undertaken many, many steps to desegregate. But they have not been well received by some quarters. For instance, even in the time at the time when, Pak La was the Minister of Education, he introduced the integrated school system, where he wanted to bring all the races together to the same roof and with different mediums. But the Chinese completely refused to budge. That was the first one. After that, they were trying to pose non-Mandarin-speaking heads and senior assistants in Chinese schools. But that, I think, was a very strange move. And then they came about vision schools, where two or three different types of schools and administration are placed under the same building or in the same area. And no go. The opposition from the Chinese was really... The Chinese are always now scared about losing the identity, the characteristic of the Chinese school. They wanted that maintained. That is a problem. And rightly so, because they felt that if they gave in to these kinds of things, then it is a step nearer to converting their schools into national medium. That was a problem then. Then even the teaching of maths and science and English was opposed by both the Chinese and the Malays. They didn't want to lose the character of Chinese schools. And the Malays felt that teaching two subjects, maths and science, which were quite difficult subjects, the logic and whatnot to be understood in English by a group of children whose mother tongue learning was in Malay, was a difficult process. In the rural areas, I think. I'm not talking about the urban elites who say, that's very good, yeah, we can do that. But what will happen to 90%? You're sacrificing about 60 to 70% of the children's educational progress in maths and science by doing this. We, in a sense, in Malaysia, the teachers were also not well prepared. The only program that I know they have taken easily to is a program called Rancangan Integrasi Murid Untuk Perpaduan, RMIUP. There's a program called RIMUP. That is the only program that is acceptable to the Chinese because the integration was only at the area of extracurricular activities. Nothing was done to the academic side of education, Chinese education. That is the only one they agreed to. But I think my own personal view would be if the remove school system, class system, or Malay teaching in remove classes was strengthened, and if there was a very good mother tongue language instruction, the POL, pupils' own language instruction in primary and Tamil national, in primary Malay or the primary national and secondary schools in Malaysia, there will be a lot of movement to these schools. That is one area we have neglected. We are not implementing a really good Malay language policy, teaching of Malay to non-Malays. If that policy was improved, then I think you would find the movement taking place. Because the people are not interested in learning everything in their mother. If we have a strong remove class policy, which is improved and enhanced, and the government is committed to improving this, and they're not shortchanged. Because at the moment, what is happening is, if in a school 15 students request for it, we'll offer one. That puts it on a kind of a very uncertain future of the language. Only if there is a demand. Why don't you teach, make a class there which will teach Tamil or Chinese to the Tamil or Chinese children, no matter what the number is. Make it compulsory. Because we are thinking in terms of the effect it will have, national unity will have. This little bit of investment in this would go a long way towards building a good multiracial nation in the country. That has got to be looked at properly.
Professor, thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Thank you very much for listening to me.
I've been speaking to Professor R. Santhiram, Dean of the School of Education, Languages and Communications, Wawasan Open University. You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.